Hi, everyone. Welcome to Second Wind Women. I'm here today with Emma Collier. Is that the right way to say it? Collier?
Perfect.
Okay. Awesome. Emma Collier is the owner and principal coach of Aspire Executive Coaching, where she helps leaders turn everyday interactions into powerful two-way conversations that spark trust, creativity, and results. Known for her down-to-earth approach and energy in the room, she transforms tough talks into growth moments that bring teams closer together. She's a certified ICF coach and emotional intelligence practitioner. She's based in Canada. Emma works with leaders all around the world, helping them communicate with clarity, lead with empathy, and enjoying the ride along the way. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So tell us a little bit how you started out your career and what your transition point was and kind of how you ended up doing the executive coaching that you're doing now.
Yeah. So way back in time, I actually trained as a landscape architect and worked in the environmental sector for most of my career. And during that time when I was in England, I worked for a government agency and I had the opportunity to be coached. And I'd never been coached before and was really blown away with the difference it made. It was a very different learning experience than a traditional training course.
Right.
And that piqued my curiosity. And so when I had the opportunity to train as a coach internally in that organization, I grabbed it and that started my coaching journey. And we moved to Canada in 2018. And at the time, I got a leadership role here in Ontario, but I was really wanting to work for myself, but also really push that coaching piece as well, because that was something I was really keen to do. And I kind of felt I wasn't doing enough of it. So that kind of pushed me to go through the training, go to the certification, and then ultimately set my business up in 2021. Awesome. So yeah, that's my journey so far.
So what is a landscape architect?
So I guess a good description would be you're designing the outside space. So the spaces between buildings. Some people say, oh, it's a garden designer. It's like, no, it's bigger. Think bigger scale. So for a lot of work I used to do was kind of urban planning. Maybe there was a developer that was coming in to create commercial building and they needed some design for the outside space. And it might have even been like car parking, planting within car parking areas, that kind of stuff. But a lot of it was big scale, working with developers to really put those proposals together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And did you ever work like in conjunction with, is it civic engineers?
Civil engineers, yes.
Civil engineers, yeah. I couldn't know which one it was.
Yes, so work with engineers, architects, planners, project managers, the whole piece.
So you were, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this because I never heard of it before. Although I did have a friend who designed spaces for the Olympics, which sounds like a little bit similar.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like the creative director and you are working with a project manager and engineers and all that, and you're putting together like the aesthetic part of it, or you're more, how does that work? Like if you would, because right now it sounds like just a whole bunch of people.
Yes.
Yeah, so are you the project manager? Are you the project manager?
Typically on a large project, it would be the engineer or maybe the architect is holding the overall piece. So then the landscape architect is coming in as part of that project team to add design around those spaces externally, where an architect is all about the building and inside, the landscape architect is all about the outside space. So, but typically because the bigger piece is the building or the engineering piece, they would often lead those big projects. And as a landscape architect, you're collaborating with them and coming up with proposals as well. It's kind of planning proposals and submissions and all that fun stuff.
How did you even find out about that?
Oh my goodness. I think at the age of, I guess, 18, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life at that point. And I really enjoyed art. And I really enjoy geography. And I was like, how do I combine these things together? And I think my mother had actually spoken to, well, it was my grandmother. And she was like, oh, there's a lady down our road and her daughter's doing landscape architecture. Well, that sounds interesting. What is that? And so did a bit of research, ended up applying and ended up going down that route and doing a degree. So that was kind of what led into that. But yeah, a bit of chance discovery, I'm going to say.
That's amazing. And it's a much more practical application of art and design than a lot of people end up doing.
Yeah.
Right.
How about you? How did you get into what you were doing? I'm curious.
I got into tech. I actually went to art school. I went to the Art Institute of Chicago, and I studied sculpture and film and performance. And that was amazing. And I made jewelry professionally for years, made art jewelry professionally. And then I got to a point and I'm like, I need to do something better with my life. So I went to school, of course, for philosophy.
Okay.
Because that's a big moneymaker. So I went to school. I went to school for Buddhist. I studied Buddhist philosophy. I did Buddhist studies with a minor in Tibetan language.
Wow.
So I got out of there and I'm like, I got to do something. And so I figured out that I could apply kind of my Buddhist philosophy study to UX design. And I had the design background from art. And then I had the capability to actually code and work with computers. So I started, that's when I started working with small businesses on, websites and social media and advertising and marketing and that kind of stuff.
Wow. So it combined it all.
Yeah, I did combine it all. And it makes it sound so organized when we say it in hindsight. But I always see people like you who are like, oh, I found this one thing and I went and I did exactly that. I'm like, wow, that must have been amazing.
Yes, but you kind of always then question, have I gone down the right path? And sometimes, yes, and I don't think I would change anything I did, but there's so many other paths and it's just trying to figure out what at that time is the best one, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you end up getting in a kind of a leadership position? And that was within the landscape architect role, right?
I guess it was. So I only did landscape architecture for a few years before I kind of transitioned into more environmental impact assessment work. And during that time, I started leading teams doing that kind of work. And then that led to leading bigger teams and then eventually kind of a department of, I'm going to say, 60 to 70 people that were kind of very operational focus, all kind of in the environmental sector. So people that specialized in water quality, waste management, flood risk management, lots of different sectors, but you're leading those individuals across a range of different areas.
So is environmental impact kind of similar to what we would call sustainability? Or is it more like just understanding the impact of things and not trying to lessen the effect of things on the environment?
So it is different to sustainability. Environmental impact assessment, particularly in England and I'm saying Canada, it's a requirement for development. So often, and particularly the large scale one, they will require you to do an environmental assessment. So you're looking at what are the big scale impacts across a range of different factors. So it could be noise, air pollution, it could be water quality. You're looking at a range of things and saying, what is the likely impact? How are we going to mitigate for those impacts? And do we need to compensate for any damage or loss to protected areas or the environment? So you're looking at species, ecology, that kind of thing as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a discipline in its own right. And there's people that's all they do. You're kind of producing reports, pulling information together. There's quite a lot to it.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And so you are managing these kind of environmental engineers and scientist type professionals.
Yeah, helping to bring it all together. So there'll be a number of disciplines involved. So you're collating all of that information and then coming up with, okay, this is what the whole picture looks like. And these are the options. And this is the recommendations we're putting forward. So that information then goes forward as part of a proposal for a government agency to review to say, okay, yes, this is acceptable, or yes, but we need these things in place, or no, we need to go back and look at things again.
So was this a consulting firm or was this an actual builder that had you guys all on staff?
So when I was doing this, I actually worked for a government agency. So the team was very much reviewing work that consultants did to make sure it was all compliant. The development, a lot of the work we did was around flood risk capital projects. So big scale projects. So making sure, for example, the consulting with the public had been done appropriately, there's lots of different legal processes you have to go through. So it's bringing all of that together. Yeah, the team that I was looking after were doing all of that. So multiple projects, lots of different programs going on, and just making sure we were delivering what we should do.
So you're a real connector, right? You work a lot with a lot of different people.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is probably a really great basis for... Yeah. And I mean, that sounds like that's a great basis for coaching, right? Because you're having all these different kind of experiences with not only managing people, but seeing how people are managing each other. And
yes. And I say one of the big things I learned through being on project teams is what works and what doesn't work, and how to, you know, some project teams are amazing, and you get on them and you're like, wow, how, you know, this is just so great. It's such a great feeling. Everybody is getting on with each other. Things are working well. And then you get on another one and it's like, oh, I really don't want to be here. When is this project going to finish? This is awful. We're dragging our heels. And so you start to pick up little pieces. Most of it's around communication and how well people communicate with each other, and how the person leading that project or program is setting the tone as well. So seeing a lot of things over the years that I've kind of picked out, okay, this is a good thing to do, or maybe this needs to be thought about differently. But yeah, lots of different layers, I'm going to say, within that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm personally just fascinated with communication right now, as I've worked with small business owners over years and years and years. Years ago, I did a training, and coming from England, you'll have a different perspective on a technique called Red Nose.
Okay.
It's a theater training based on Commedia dell'arte. Yeah. And the main school of the guy who developed it is in Paris. And it's just this great technique. You know, it's a theater technique where you basically kind of understand how people view you, like have a more empathetic communication with other people. And it's really, like, in general, it's used in theater to develop ensembles, right? Because in ensembles, you really need that trust, right? There's a lot at, I mean, you're not going to lose your job, but there's a lot at stake, and you need to trust your team members, and you need to communicate instantaneously with people. So there's a great, like, building that happens during the process for this. And so I've really been looking into using that in corporate teams, because, like you're saying, communication is so important. And if you're managing a project and people can't communicate, if they're reading intent incorrectly, if they're getting competitive with people within the team instead of building on each other, I mean, it can really mess things up.
Yeah, I love that. The ensemble, the word that came up for me was risk-taking. There's a bit of risk-taking in there, but I love that, kind of straight in it, you're having to communicate. So true. You can think of many examples where things just don't go right. And then things are, you're having to spend a lot of time then filling in gaps, right, putting energy into areas that you don't want to particularly put energy into, just to keep things on track. So yeah, I love that description. Meta note, yeah. Red Nose.
Yeah. People in the United States don't really know about Red Nose and what that is, but that's fine. That's fine. But yeah, I was on a development project where the manager, it was a software development project, and the manager, two weeks before release, wanted us to evaluate whether there were any other changes that needed to be made. Wow. And yeah, everybody was pulling their hair out. But communication. So tell us how you ended up in the coaching space. You said you had some training, and there was some stuff about emotional intelligence training.
Yeah, I guess I've added different tools to what I can offer clients. And emotional intelligence was something that I was really intrigued in, and clients really love it. And so that assessment process, then the debrief, and you've got a report then to take away with you and to kind of review. I found that report in particular is highly accurate. The clients are like, wow, it's describing me. This is amazing. And so that is something I really enjoy working with clients on, and then figuring out, where do you want to focus your energy then? So these are your strengths. These are some potential development areas. What is jumping out? You know, it's not for me to dictate that. And clients generally have I really want to focus on this spot, this one here. This is really intriguing for me. I want to work on that. So I think it's an eye-opening process.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like it. So when did you decide to become your own woman?
Yeah, so I guess like a lot of people through COVID, I was reevaluating what I wanted to do with my life. And so that kind of set a number of things in motion. I was like, okay, I'm going to set my business up. I was still employed at the time. It's something I've always wanted to do. I dabbled a little bit years ago when I was a landscape architect. I worked for myself for some 18 months just doing some consulting work. So I knew I could, the logistics of setting up a business didn't scare me because I knew I've done that bit before.
Right.
But it was more than the business development side. It's like, well, how do I get clients? How do I find clients? Nobody knows me in Canada. I am this person. I have all my network in England, which is completely unhelpful here. Mm-hmm. And so that piece was the big challenge initially, was kind of how to do that and what to go through. And I found a program that worked for me. It was literally for coaches setting up businesses, and there's a bit of mentoring training in there. And so I took that investment, and that helped me then have kind of that courage to kickstart things and how to approach different situations.
Okay. You know, we kind of glossed over the fact that you moved across an ocean.
Yes. That was an adventure, I'm going to say.
Yeah. Tell us about that. How did that happen?
Yeah. So my husband worked at the time for a company called Rolls-Royce in England, and he was asked whether he'd be interested in running a business over here in Canada. And so we came to check it out, and we were like, okay, if we don't do this, we're never going to do it. And so we decided to go with it. So I left my job in England and then spent 6 months probably trying to transition us out of being in England and letting out our home for rent, getting the boys finished school, and then trying to find a place to live over here. And it goes on, this huge, huge list of things. But that was that initial, my husband's job initially kind of.
How long did that take? It's such an intense process.
Yeah, I'm trying to think back. So I think in 2018, we came out to Canada in March to check out the area and say, do we want to do this or not? And we kind of quickly decided, yeah, we do. And then my husband started his job in May. So he was actually, it sounds ridiculous, he was commuting. So every 2 weeks, he would come back to England and then he'd go back. He would just do these ridiculous journeys. And so I was the one at home. The boys were still in school. We knew they had to finish school kind of July. So it's like, well, I'll stay here, try and pack up the home, sort everything out. So at that point, April, I left my job. So I'm like, okay, I just need to focus on sorting everything out. So yeah, so from kind of March until July was just sorting out a new home, finding out about schools in Canada, where to live, you know, what we might do. There was so much. So yeah, a lot of paperwork. And then I think we visited again in May with the boys so we could get them to check out the area. We visited a few schools over here as well, and really boring things like registering for healthcare and all that kind of fun stuff and getting that moving. So that by the time we did move over, which I think was beginning of August, end of July, beginning of August, we had a few things in place. And
how old were your boys when you moved them over?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think, 10 and 14, I think, at the time. Yeah. So the youngest one wasn't such a big deal, but the elder one was he'd started high school in England, and then he had to go back and finish a year of elementary school, which was like, oh my gosh.
Ouch.
Yeah. He was like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, we just let him float through that year a little bit. So it was just trying to get used to being in Canada again. But it was, lots of challenges for everybody. And I think, you know, kids get on with it, but it was certainly not an easy time.
Yeah. Yeah. When we talked earlier, you had said something about ageism in the workplace. Can you kind of elaborate on, how you work with people around ageism?
I guess it comes up insofar as, you know, different organizations, you'll notice there seems to be this kind of sweet spot, I guess, in terms of there's a lot of people around age 30, 40, the younger ones. But anyone, I'm going to say, getting towards, like, I'm 51 now. So 50 onwards, there's a look of, okay, so how long are you staying here? And when are you, maybe when are you retiring? And also, I've worked with a couple of clients who have been let go. And because they're very senior, they have a lot of experience and therefore they cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I unfortunately hear that a lot. And I don't personally have a remedy for that other than for myself. I knew I didn't want to put myself in that position. So that was another reason for me working for myself. It's like, well, I've only got myself to blame if things don't work out.
Right.
I can build this. I can focus on this. I don't need to be worried about, will I have a job? So that for me was a real nudge as well to work for myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that's, I remember being at a kid's birthday party when my kids were in elementary school and some of the moms were older and they were like, you know, I want to get back into the workforce, but, you know, and these were people who were late 40s at the time, and they were already feeling, you know, some ageism around that because there's this conception that young people are going to put more energy into things and be around longer. And I think that's misguided.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think those, I'm going to say employees who have been taken on later on in life, who've come back into employment, are the best, most loyal employees you're ever going to get and are going to work their socks off to do a good job. I think what I've found as well is sometimes younger people view, you know, anyone over the age of 40 as like, oh, they don't know how to use technology. Yeah. They don't know how to do things. They're going to be really slow. And so you're kind of fighting with that a little bit. And I've experienced it a few times in group settings when I'm working with a group on a particular issue that comes up in conversation and you're like, okay, no, this isn't true. This is something you're perceiving to be true that isn't reality. So getting them to explore that a little bit can be really helpful.
Yeah. You remember when that there was a trend where people would call everybody boomer, everybody who was like over 40, uh-huh. They'd be like, oh, they're just dismiss them and call them a boomer. And I saw this amazing video where they were kind of fighting back against ageism. And they had like, you know, a woman who was a ballroom dancer. And she was like, and she would dance with this like 20-year-old guy. And he's like, wow, you're amazing. And she's like, I'm 65. And he's like, what? How could that be? You know, because there's this perception of being elderly, of elderly and what elderly is and being frail and confused and not of very much use. And I think that's part of the devaluation of elderly people in our culture. There was this amazing Japanese performance artist. She was like 20 and she would wear a white wig and go out in public. She said instantly, nobody saw her. Like nobody would look at her. Nobody even talk with her. She became invisible. And I think that's something that, you know, so many of us fear as we get older, you know, and it's not only being devalued in the workplace, but it's just being ignored.
Yeah, I do hear it a lot. And like you, I see a lot on social media and it's like, oh, boomer, Gen X, you know, this is how they operate. It's like, okay, you're maybe generalizing a little bit here. And I think just wanting to take control of your own destiny a little bit comes into play with a lot of this. But I appreciate that's not for everybody as well. So it's how do you accommodate for everybody then in the work setting when you've got a range of 20-somethings to people in their 60s? You know, it's what does that look like? And are you supporting people in the right way and getting the most from them?
Right. So when you're working with clients who are managing teams like that, how do you guide them to kind of see the uniqueness, you know, the unique contributions of each member of their team?
Yeah, I often work with groups. So I'll get groups and maybe in pairs, have a conversation together, but really try and get them to draw out of each other. What are their unique strengths? What experiences do they have? How would they approach, you know, particularly around communication? That's a lot of the area I focus on. So often the more experienced members of the group will say, well, hey, this is how I would approach this conversation. And they have some great insights. And so then the younger members are like, oh, wow, okay, I'd never thought about it that way. I'm saying generally not always. There are some older generation who maybe have a very, I'm say, blunt approach to communication, which also does not land well. So there's a bit of learning from both sides and sharing, you know, best practices, if you like.
And that's more in your group programs?
Yeah, I do. I continue to do a lot of training around giving and receiving feedback, having those difficult conversations. And a lot of that work is maybe there's a cohort of 8 to 10 people and I split them into smaller groups. So they'll often be in pairs and threes and fours and then kind of learning from each other as well as learning a little bit from me in terms of different approaches. So that's how I like to work. Yeah.
Feedback is hard. I have to say one of the things that I miss the most about art school is feedback. They called it a critique, which is and people had a really hard time with it, but I felt like it was amazing because it gives you the opportunity to step back from, I mean, in the case of art school, right? You're stepping back from your work and you're kind of seeing it from different people's perspective. But in any situation where you're asking for feedback, you have to have that ability to like pull your personal offense out of it. And that's such a skill.
Yeah.
And it's such a skill you need to like keep on. You don't just like learn it once and then you've got it. Right.
Yeah. So I'm curious then what your approach was to kind of receiving that critique.
You know, it's very much like I try to, when I'm in a position like that, whether it's, you know, in an art critique situation or in a team feedback situation, it's so much harder in a team feedback situation. But to just kind of like put yourself in the observing spot instead of the being observed spot.
Yeah.
And it's just a little reframe. It's like I recently gave a speech and somebody said, well, how do you prepare for giving a speech in front of so many people? And I said, I don't think about giving a speech in front of a bunch of people. Think about having an experience together with these people. Because that way you're less defensive. That way you're less nervous. And I think the same thing works with feedback, right? If you see yourself as part of a group, part of a team, and you're trying to improve, but again, removing yourself from your labors is so much harder than removing yourself from your investment in an object that you've made.
So true. I love that reframe. That's something I talk about, is that stepping away, looking at yourself, becoming an observer in the future. You know, will this moment be important? Probably not. So let's not, you know, make it into a big thing that it really isn't. That observer piece is key. So yeah,
I love the time travel. That's great. No, seriously, that's a great way to depersonalize your emotional investment.
I would say that often works for people because they're like, oh yeah, probably not. You know, trying to get them to think, so what happened 10 years ago when you had a feedback conversation? Can you remember that conversation?
Right.
No. So you're unlikely to remember this one 5, 10 years down the line. So it's not that big thing.
Yeah. De-stressing. Taking the intensity out of things, I think, can help you think so much more clearly.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you work with people now? How do people find you? And how do you work with them in general?
Yeah. So right now, the best way to find me is on my website. So that is aspireexecutivecoaching.com. And typically I have a call with people first, whether it's individual or with an organization, to work out, you know, what people are looking for and if there's a fit. And if it's an organization, I usually put a proposal together and work with the client on that to ensure they're getting the outcomes they're looking for. With an individual, it's very much, what is the goal you're looking for from this, right, you know, program? And then it is coming up with a suitable program for them. Sometimes it's more career focused. Sometimes it's more performance in the job focus as well. So it's trying to establish what clients are ideally looking for.
And yeah, how do you quantify the results that people get with, you know, after going through your program or with working with you long term?
Yeah, I think the career coaching piece is easier because often they're coming with I want to get promoted, I want a new job, I want this and this. So the return on investment is within 3 to 6 months, they've secured a new position, they've got a promotion, they're very happy with it. The less easy one to quantify is if people are just looking for personal effectiveness, improvements, they're then coming back and saying, oh, I have more clarity on this, I feel more confident with this, I was able to deal with these difficult situations more effectively. They're getting feedback from their manager that things have significantly changed or improved or enhanced. So that is really the kind of qualitative feedback, I think, from that piece as well. Organizations often do surveys before I enter the space. So they may have a survey that says this, and then may then resurvey after the training or the development that we do together to see, okay, what is the difference? Has this been worth it? The answer is usually yes. So I think that is a really great way of doing it as well. I'm curious about you. So you asked me about this. How do you work with people?
I mean, like I said, I'm kind of in a space right now where, I mean, I don't know if it's because of ageism or because I'm just, you know, I've been working doing digital marketing and websites for ages and ages, and I do want to get into a more human space, which is why I'm focusing more on the team building and the red nose stuff. So yeah, I'm literally in a transition right now. I still have, you know, many, many, many clients that I'm doing the same stuff for, but moving into working more with teams, you know, using these techniques and seriously, like, bring back fun. People aren't having fun.
Yes.
You know, we're in such an age of such intensity. I mean, you talk about stress and intensity and quantifying, like we're in such an age where your boss can measure your keystrokes and how fast you're typing as a measure of how efficient you are being, which is not actually a measure of how efficient you're being. But really, I think everyone is so uptight and tense, and people are not enjoying, they're not enjoying being in a team with other people. They're not enjoying being human. I think there's a lot of, I feel like there's going to be a little bit of a backlash to how tied we are into all these technological platforms. And, you know, you got to work with people. And you might as well enjoy it. And the more you enjoy it, the more effective you are and the happier you are. So to me, that's a no-brainer.
I love that. And I absolutely agree. I think there is so much technology, it's overwhelming. And people almost just like, there's too much now. And so any chance to interact with a person, they kind of jump out. You know, I'm seeing a lot of different communities popping up, depending on people's hobbies and interests. And I see that's where people want to be there. They want to be interacting with people who have similar likes to them, or maybe focused on a particular development area that they're interested in. And just those kind of touch points, because I must say, particularly in the leadership space, it's lonely enough anyway. And then you add in kind of the virtual working, add all the technology, you're suddenly kind of in this very small space on your own. And so there's a real need for kind of reaching out and reconnecting in person to see somebody and have a conversation.
And camaraderie is like such an important thing in teams. And I think so oftentimes we get into a space where we think camaraderie means complaining.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So I'm, like I said, I'm really focused on moving towards a more human element, because I have been, you know, I was just saying earlier that I've been, you know, neck deep in a server for the last couple of days, working on some stuff, which is great and fun and awesome, but not satisfying. And not, you talk about developing your expertise, not only as a leader, but as a communicator. You can't do that without people.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Interesting times.
Yeah, for sure. So how can people find you, Emma?
So my website, aspireexecutivecoaching.com, is where people can find me. I also have some free resources around feedback. So if you go to needmoretrust.com, you'll find a video and worksheet and a cheat sheet as well. So kind of help with those conversations around feedback that often feel very challenging.
That is an amazing domain name, by the way.
Thank you.
I always notice those. Well, cool. Thanks so much for talking with me today. And it was a joy talking to you, Emma.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure being here today. Appreciated the conversation.
Thanks for watching today. I'm glad you watched the whole thing. If you could do us a favor, it would help so much if you hit subscribe. It helps give us just a little boost to keep this podcast going. Thank you.